rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group Up By It for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up in today's program in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Cass Ingram says uranium oxide in the air is causing severe health effects. Stephen Freeman and Joel Leibus are dropping by on their new book, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? And plus your calls and just piles and piles of great news. It is the duty, our quote for the day, it is the duty of every citizen, according to his best capacities, to give validity to his convictions in political affairs. Albert Einstein, who certainly saw it up close and personal, a refugee from Nazi Germany, saw up close and personal what happens when people don't get involved in political affairs as things are going south. Our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And if you'd like to drop by our live chat room, feel free. Just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you right there. And drop in and say hi. Weapons of mass destruction found. Yeah, that's what Ricky Santorum wants you to believe. And Pete Hoekstra, we've got the congressman from Michigan and the senator from Pennsylvania. I think somebody has changed the mushrooms in the cafeteria at the U.S. Congress. I think that they've been putting psilocybin in instead of shiitake. These guys are clearly hallucinating. Back in 2003, as we were scouring across Iraq, looking for the so-called weapons of mass destruction that represented such a terrible threat to the United States, you will recall George W. Bush saying, you know, that this is a threat. This we've got to, you know, we've got to worry about this. There are weapons of mass destruction there. We need to be going after these things. The Saddam Hussein regime represents a clear and present danger and a serious threat. And quack quack quack, and you know, going on and on and on about it. So you know, people actually believed this. I'm not sure that Colin Powell ever actually believed it, but you know, a lot of Americans believed it. A lot of GIs believed it. A lot of people believed it, tragically. And you know, when Bush was making these statements, and apparently a lot of people still want to believe it. And I think it's really important that we remember the lies that Bush was putting forward.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
Now, okay, 9/11. So 9/11 had to do with what, George?
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
Turns out it wasn't true, and he knew it at the time. In fact, he had sat down with Tony Blair and said, you know, we're basically going to lie about this stuff because we're going to have a war. Bush continued.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
The most serious dangers of our age. And this is what Santorum and Hoekstra would have us think they have found in Iraq. These guys went on Fox News. They went on Fox News last night and said, yep, we have found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, it turns out back in 2003, when we were first looking around the country And David Kay was doing his scrub. We spent $1 billion, by the way, looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Not to mention the money that, you know, the cost of soldiers looking for them at the same time they were trying to secure the country. We spent $1 billion on this, and sure enough, we found about 500 here, there, you know, here, there, and elsewhere. Here and there, you'd find, oh, here's a dozen here, here's a couple. Old shells, old artillery shells that had sarin gas in them, or that had mustard gas in them. Problem was, they were so old, they were so rusted, they were so corroded that they couldn't be fired. They were all pre-1991. And the gas in them had degraded to the point where it couldn't be used. These were the weapons that Don Rumsfeld and George Bush Sr., when he was president of the United States, sold to Saddam Hussein to use in his war against Iran. They were weapons that in the efforts to destroy all the weapons in Iraq, Hussein somehow overlooked. They were not being hidden and kept aside because they were useless. They could not be used. And yet Santorum is coming out with, this is a right out of the Goebbels playbook. Tell a big lie, make it such an audacious lie that the other side is so shocked by it as a lie that they will assume that everybody will realize it as a lie and they will therefore not rebut it. And then repeat that lie often enough, and people will come to believe it. And that's what they're doing. Last night, Alan Colmes on Hannity and Colmes actually called them on it, quoting a guy at the Pentagon. I mean, he actually called up the Pentagon, checked this thing out. The Pentagon says, no, no, sorry, there's nothing there. And here's Alan Colmes, first of all, talking to Rick Santorum last night.
The Iraq survey group says Iraq did not have the weapons that our intelligence believed were there. And Jim Angle, who reported this for Fox News, quotes a defense official who says these were pre-1991 weapons that could not have been fired as designed because they've already been degraded. And the official went on to say that these are not the WMDs this country and the rest of the world believed Iraq had, and not the WMDs for which this country went to war. So the chest beating that the Republicans are doing tonight, seeking this as a justification, is not confirmed by the Defense Department.
Yes, and Santorum... You watch the videotape of it, and Santorum is, you know, his eyes are just darting all over the place. Like, how am I going to get out of this one? This guy's calling me on my lies. Well, I guess I'll just have to lie even more. I'll have to say, well, that's not the real Defense Department that says that those are pre-1991. I want to talk to the real Defense Department. I mean, can you imagine even thinking like that? Here's Santorum's response.
Well, I'd like to know who that Defense Department spokesperson is. The fact of the matter is, I'll wait and see what the actual Defense Department formally says, or more importantly, the administration formally says.
Yeah, and of course, the administration is going to come out and say, no, Santorum's lying. No, of course not. This is right out of Karl Rove's playbook. Actually, it's right out of Joseph Goebbels' playbook. And so later on, Fox News has another guy on, another analyst, and they say to him, well, you know, what do you think of this? You know, where's this coming from? What's the deal here? And this guy says, oh, yeah, this is a conspiracy between the United States, apparently not the Bush administration, but people in the administration. You know, it's a government conspiracy, after all, between people in the United States not to embarrass Russia, China, and France. Now, tell me, what do Russia and China and France have to do with it? Who knows? I'm telling you, whatever the mushrooms are that they're putting in the food over there that the Republicans are eating at the House and Senate, and it must just be, you know, they have their daily meetings and their prayer breakfasts and their weekly get-together with Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff and figure out what the talking points are going to be. It must be one of those things, one of those Republican meals, because it has apparently spread all the way over to Fox News. The whole bunch of them are hallucinating. And the tragedy of it is that as soon as Santorum came out and said this, and Drudge, of course, is flogging this thing. It's up at the top at Drudge.com, DrudgeReport.com. And as soon as this came out, there should have been a rebuttal. The Democrats should have been going, I can't believe Rick Santorum would lie to the American people like that. Because, frankly, I'm telling you, I can't believe Rick Santorum would lie to the American people like that. It's like the lie of George W. Bush.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And we know now that he knew when he said it was a lie.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions.
Lie.
We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Yeah, thousands of tons. And we've found a few, about 500 old, degraded, rusted-out shells from pre-1991. And we found them 3 years ago. And Ricky Santorum and Pete Hoekstra are now running around television going, hey, look at this! We actually have weapons of mass destruction! Well, actually, there were some weapons of mass destruction found. And some people are dismantling them. Some real ones. I'll tell you about that right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
For the safety of our homeland, I think we've been through this before. Sent our kids to die in Vietnam to keep the commies from our door. Now they tell us there's a way to live.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
There you go. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. I mentioned that weapons of mass destruction have been found. They were found in North Dakota. A Roman Catholic priest and two veterans went to a Minuteman III silo this morning. This would be yesterday morning, and began to disarm the nuclear weapons using hammers. Reverend Carl Kabat, OMI, Gregory Birche Obed, and Michael Wally entered the E-9 missile silo on the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation in North Dakota, about 75 miles southwest of Minot. Using a sledgehammer and household hammers, they disabled the lock on the personnel entry latch that provides access to the warhead, and they hammered on the silo lid that covers the 300,000-ton nuclear warhead that is targeted and ready to launch. 300-kiloton nuclear warhead. The activists painted disarm on the face of the 110-ton hardened silo cover, and the peace activists poured their own blood on the missile lid. They were, of course, detained and arrested by McLean County sheriffs. They're being held in the county jail in Washburn, North Dakota right now. Carl Kabat, OMI, from St. Louis, the Catholic priest, said, "We now prepare for the nuclear bombing of Iran with the reasoning that only weapons of mass destruction can stop weapons of mass destruction. We bombed and strafed in Iraq based on lies that the Iraqis possess nuclear weapons. We have the weapons here." The news story adds the Minuteman III missile is targeted and on alert for launch. It's armed with a warhead that carries 27 times the heat, blast, and radiation of the bomb dropped by the United States on Hiroshima in Japan in 1945. The activists say they're following the nonviolent leader Jesus, that they are taught by their faith to love their enemies, and that the money used for these weapons of mass destruction is a theft from the poor and should be used for food, housing, medical care, and rebuilding the infrastructure of their country. Gee, sounds pretty radical to me. You know, I don't know. It certainly doesn't sound like anything, for example, a Republican would say. You know, it just doesn't. Or does it? Here's Dwight Eisenhower.
Every gun that is made, every warship launch, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican Eisenhower, the Republican President of the United States, speaking before the American Society of Newspaper Editors in Washington, D.C., April 16, 1953. The world at arms is not spending money alone. So, yes, we have found weapons of mass destruction. They're in North Dakota. And these shells that they found, that Rick Santorum and Pete Hoekstra are running around saying, well, the real Pentagon may say that they're, but we want to talk to the alternative universe Pentagon, the bizarro world Pentagon.
Well, I'd like to know who that Defense Department spokesperson is. The fact of the matter is, I'll wait and see what the actual Defense Department.
Yeah, we want to talk to the actual Defense Department. You know, the one that where the funny hats. They have inflatable shoes. You can squeeze the nose. It goes honk honk. We've got a serious problem in the United States, and the problem is called Republicans using the strategy book of Joseph Goebbels and promulgating the big lie. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls and more after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. Too many left. I don't have time to go round and round and round. Too late to make it right. Probably wouldn't if I could. Cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what
Lab has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
Why?
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
Lie. And he knew it! No, we're not ready to make nice. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Associated Press. Democrats want change in Iraq. This is a great, I believe it was George Allen. No, it wasn't George Allen. Who was it? Dick Durbin. 100% of the Democratic caucus believes it's time for change. Why do they use the word caucus? Most people don't even know what caucus means. He should say it's all the Democrats getting together. It's like a beehive or something. I'd say, why doesn't he just say 100% of the Democrats in Congress? Somebody has to tell the Democrats to stop using big words. Well, it's only 2 syllables. In any case, 100%, Dick Durbin, 100% of the Democratic caucus believes it's time for a change. 100% of the Republican caucus believes it's time to stay the course. Yeah. And yet yesterday I'm watching Hardball, and here's Nora O'Donnell, who is fairly openly Republican. You know, her partisan bent became really obvious during the last election. And she's talking to Joe Biden, and she's like, Senator, aren't you ashamed of your party or embarrassed for your party that they're so divided on this issue? And then a little later on in the interview, she says she's talking to Joe Biden, and she and you know, another one of these, aren't you embarrassed, aren't you ashamed kind of questions, you know, saying, do you really think it's useful to use talking points like John Kerry is using about, you know, they want to lie and die? And I was just waiting for Joe Biden to say, Nora, I'm going to reach through this TV screen and grab you by the throat. That this, how the Bush administration, with their cut and run, they're repeating it like a mantra, and you're accusing Democrats of using slogans? But he didn't. He behaved like a gentleman. I guess, you know, God bless him. But the tragedy, the ongoing tragedy that is the U.S. occupation of Iraq, continues. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Steve in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? I've talked to you before. You know I'm a Republican. I want to throw a monkey wrench and say, I think Chris Santorum is playing politics, to be honest with you. I don't think it's any big deal what they found, but they should have kept it secret. Now he just kicked off a scavenger hunt of Al-Qaeda in Iraq looking for the weapons of mass destruction.
Except those were useless weapons.
What?
Al-Qaeda is not as stupid as Rick Santorum. They are not going to look for weapons that can't be used.
Well, wait a sec. Hold it. Now, you're not going to store that stuff in your garage. Just because it's old doesn't mean there's probably not some usable stuff in there, right? And that wasn't the justification of the war. I'm not saying this exonerates Bush, but Rick Santorum trying to use it as politics. I'm trying to not be a hypocrite here. I mean, I'm for their secrets of war, and I think they're letting way too much information out.
Well, it's, right? I mean, this is stuff that was discussed in the Darfur report 2 years ago, Steve. This is old news.
Well, haven't you? I mean, if you release that, then you're telling the insurgency that there's weapons of mass destruction laying around.
Yeah, they don't even need weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the reality is that the United States we were notified by Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei of hundreds of sites where there were thousands of tons of conventional munitions. And this is after the occupation began. The United Nations notified us and said, you know, you got to watch out, because if there is an insurgency, these guys are going to be able to lay their hands on old rocket shells and old mortar shells and things and turn them into IEDs, and they're going to use them against you. And we did not secure any of those munition dumps. They got looted, and those weapons are being used against us right now. They don't need to go looking for weapons of mass destruction. They got plenty of good old-fashioned TNT or dynamite or cordite or whatever it is that they find in these normal shells. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I have only questions, and these are all questions. Do you believe that George Tenet was a co-conspirator with President Cheney and the Minister of War Rumsfeld, where he would take the fall for feeding them false information? The other one is...
Well, let me just answer you, Will. I honestly don't know.
Okay. Well,
I honestly don't know whether Tenet was a victim of the conspiracy or whether he was part of the conspiracy. I don't know. And that is one of the reasons why we need to have a serious investigation of this, which will not happen as long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate.
This is a direct question at you. I would like for you over the weeks to explain to us what would your operational procedure would be for withdrawing from there, and I am in favor of withdrawing, and would you leave a contingency over there to keep Iran out of Iraq, and why is it that we are so divided when it comes to, look, we're in it, let's get out, it doesn't matter, and why are we at each other's throats here?
Yeah, well, here, number one, in terms of getting out, I think Jack Murtha laid it out very well. He said, you know, retreat to or pull back to or redeploy, actually, is the word that he used. Take your troops out of harm's way. What you've got right now is a civil war going on. Our troops are caught in the middle. You've got some people who are fighting, you know, you've got Sunni and Shia who are fighting against each other. Our troops are caught in the middle of that. And then, even worse, you've got some 80% of Iraqis think that it's okay to shoot at Americans. I mean, the Iraqi Congress, the Iraqi Parliament, just seriously considered and narrowly rejected a proposal to give amnesty to any Iraqi citizen who was found guilty of killing an American.
Paul.
I mean, that's that. You know, our soldiers have bullseyes on their backs, and it's time to get them out.
Tom, last question, but also a comment then, please. Who is the Ministry of Propaganda down in Washington? Who heads that, all this propaganda? The other one...
Karl Rove.
Thank you. I thought so. Thank you, Tom. The other one is that I do not care if they kill each other for the next 20 years, Tom. I mean it. I'm so fed up with us losing our people. And the last thing is, he went over to Europe. He was down there in Austria, and now he was down in Hungary. And he has nerve to talk about freedom. In 1956, I sat with my father. Listen, from 1955 to 1956, I listened to him. He managed to smuggle a radio, and I listened to Radio Free Europe. And I remember he waited to the last day. My father was arrested twice, and the third time they were coming to shoot him.
Where was this, Will?
It was on the Austrian-Hungarian border.
Okay.
Honest to God, I heard them. I heard America, NATO, British promised the Hungarians, we will send you. You know what they promised?
Oh, yeah. We incited the uprising, and then the Russians came in and crushed it.
Do you remember this, Tom?
Yeah. Oh, I don't remember it, but I know the story. I was only 5 years old in 1956, but I know the story.
I listened to him, and they came and got him twice, the secret police that jailed him the third time. His cousin warned him they're coming to kill you, and he had to hide, and then the uprising happened. They told the Hungarians, revolt against the Russians. We will help you. We'll send you. What they need was anti-tank weapons. Yeah. Nothing came.
No. What's his name? Yeah, right. Came in and just absolutely crushed them. Something similar happened in Czechoslovakia, and then, of course, George Bush Sr. did the same thing to the Shia in 1991 in southern Iraq. And they, you know, he said, if you guys rise up against Saddam Hussein, we'll support you. And they did, and we didn't support them, and Saddam Hussein went in and slaughtered a couple hundred thousand of them. This is an old story. It seems to happen a lot with Republican administrations. The one you're describing, of course, happened under the Eisenhower-Nixon administration.
It was Dulles. Listen to me.
You think Alan Dulles was responsible for it?
Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA. And I'll tell you what, I have the utmost respect for Dwight David Eisenhower. He warned us against...
So do I, by the way.
I adore that guy. And by the way, they said, revolt, we'll come and help you. And now I remember my dad would not leave. He wanted... He was a freedom fighter. He lost three of his buddies. They went down. My mother told him, don't you dare go. You have three kids. And here's what it was. I remember when we left, and the tanks were down in the village. And I remember he grabbed the radio. This is Hungary calling. And to this day, I'll never forget it, how we were betrayed. And I'm an American citizen, and I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
Thanks,
well,
Tom.
Thank you, Will. Thank you for sharing that story with us. And this is why it's so important that America maintain its status or regain its status as the beacon of liberty for the world, as the nation that other nations will follow. Because right now we have reached the point where, yes, I mean, we betrayed Hungary. We betrayed Czechoslovakia similarly. And we betrayed the Sunnis, or the Shia, rather, in the south of Iraq. And those are probably not the only three. They're just the top three that come to the top of my mind. But in many other cases, certainly in World War I and World War II, we were there when our allies needed us. And we have been the example for the world. When the United States was created as a democratic republic in 1776 or arguably 1789, we were the first. There were no other democratic republics in the world. By the time of the Civil War, there were only a small handful. And when the Civil War happened, everybody all around the world, they thought, oh, well, so much for that experiment. We're just going to go back to kings and warlords and theocrats. And over the years now, you have nearly 100 serious democracies around the planet as a consequence of our example. We need to become that example one more time. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Kabukachu.
This is the Evans
Policeman City.
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun.
it could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, he's the decider. Well, indeed. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the middle of a vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. Our number, 866-404-8466, 404, excuse me, 866-440-THOM. And Oren in Essex Junction, Vermont on the line. Hey, Oren, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Oren?
I'm loving that song. Hey, I can't help but think I spend a lot of time with my children trying to tell them, if you see something wrong or if you know something's happening, you got to say something. You can't just stand there and do a risk analysis. Is this in my benefit? Is this going to be, something that I can benefit from? Yeah, and try to make them good citizens. And I'm trying to figure out why there hadn't been someone as a Democrat stand up and say, hey, let's take this list that Colin Powell took to the UN, and let's go down this checklist.
There have been several Democratic resolutions introduced or attempted to introduce into the House of Representatives and into the Senate to specifically investigate what Colin Powell said before the United Nations. And in every single instance, the Republicans have refused to allow them to come to the floor of the House.
Yesterday, how come nobody stood up and said, hey, let's take this checklist that Santorum and look at this stuff Santorum is talking about and see where that is on this list?
Yeah. Well,
technically, that guy's right. You can step on a grenade from World War II and hurt yourself, but figure the odds. And there's tons. It's like Iran now. Why are they building a nuclear power program so that they can build a bomb when they could buy the material or steal it from Russia?
Frankly, they're finishing the nuclear power program that we sold them and we got them all hyped up on, and they know that oil is a limited resource. And even if they are building a bomb, that's, part of the having status in the Middle East thing. They join the club along with Israel and then in the region, or broadly in the region, in Pakistan and India. And they it's their way of saying, don't mess with us, George Bush, because look what happened to Saddam Hussein. He didn't have a bomb. Thanks for the call, Lauren. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to talk about the increase in minimum wage, how it failed in Congress yesterday, but yet they managed to give themselves a raise, which I find interesting during a time of war. But anyways, letting that go.
$3,000 a year raise.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's interesting is if people don't understand the facts about minimum wage, if you go to the Congressional Budget Office, which is an arm of Congress, you see on there they talk about how 60% of minimum wage earners are people supporting their families or supporting themselves. So these are not students. These are not people living at home with their parents. These are people that are trying to make a living. So the thing that people understand about minimum wage is that when you have an increase in price, your profits go up. So because your prices have just gone up. But if you don't give a raise to your employee, their living standards stay down because then they can't afford the products. They can't afford to buy stuff because their wages stay the same.
Yeah, well said, Patricia. Actually, the way that David Ricardo, the famous economist back in 1814, pointed it out is that prices will be determined by the marketplace. In other words, by what people are willing to pay for something. Profits are determined by how much you can reduce the cost of labor in your product. So when companies are able to reduce the price of labor, they don't reduce the cost of their product. Look at tennis shoes as a great example. Tennis shoes in the United States 30, 40 years ago, $20, $30 for a pair of tennis shoes. Now they're over $100 for a pair of tennis shoes, sports shoes, and yet the cost of labor has gone down, and the net result, you've got tennis shoe billionaires like Phil Knight.
It just goes right
to the bottom line.
Yeah, the thing is, as long as minimum wage doesn't exceed the rate of inflation, you can't have a decline in real profit. That's basic economics 101. But the other thing I wanted to add to this, Tom, is that if we look at the last couple years with spending, why there's been such an increase in spending, it's because of the equity. I know here in California, the price of real estate went so crazy that people are taking equity lines, and so they're spending this money.
That's right. We are the two things that have been stimulating the U.S. economy are, number one, people taking equity out of their houses, and the value of the houses has been inflating because Greenspan drove interest rates down to try and get Bush reelected.
Right.
And number two, defense spending. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on the military, and that is stimulating the economy indirectly. But it's the worst way to stimulate an economy, because if you spend $1 billion on a road or a highway, then, you know, that road or highway will be used for years and years productively. You spend that same money on bombs and poof, it's gone as soon as it's used. It's never recoverable. Patricia, thank you for the call. Good point you made. Jared in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Jared.
Hey, Tom. Great show, and thank you for the awesome, awesome job that you're doing.
Thank you.
My question is, I talk and debate with conservatives on a fairly regular basis, and I explain to them, or I try to explain to them, that Bush essentially lied us into Iraq. And one of the first things I do is I point to the Downing Street minutes as a source for that. Mm-hmm. And then they just go right ahead and say, no, those aren't valid. They were never officially recognized by the British government, blah, 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 blah. And what I would like is basically some advice from you.
An easy response to that is then what would you think about the Republican Secretary of the Treasury for 2 years, John O'Neill? Or Paul
okay.
O'Neill, rather. Paul O'Neill, in his book with Ron Suskind, in his book wrote that the first cabinet meeting he sat in on, this is like in the first days after Bush was installed by the Supreme Court, the first subject of the first meeting was how are we going to invade Iraq?
Okay.
How can we get into Iraq? What do we have to do? What's it going to take to cause an invasion of Iraq? I want to know. And I mean, you know, and he's not the only one. Read Richard Clark's book. You know, the same thing. He's running around with his hair on fire about Osama bin Laden, and Bush is saying, you know, figure out a way to turn this into an invasion of Iraq. So that's, you know, I would start by quoting Republicans from within the Republican administration. You don't have to quote the Brits. I mean, this goes way back. Or you could quote the, you know, George W. Bush's old biographer. You know, the guy who was saying that George Bush in 1999 was saying if he had an opportunity to attack Iraq, he'd do it because he'd get political capital. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's time to take a look at some of the things you thought you knew. You thought you knew what you knew, and you thought you didn't, maybe you didn't know what you didn't know, but sometimes, you know, it's you don't even know what you don't know, what you know that you don't know that you, maybe you should know, but...
know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Have you noticed how the sunsets are getting purpler? More and more purple. In the sunsets, the old-fashioned orange-red sunsets, oh, they have a little purple in them. What's up with this? Dr. Cass Ingram is with us. Dr. Cass Ingram, the author of Natural Cures for Health Disasters, a physician and author. Cass Ingram, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Glad to have you with
yeah.
us. What is the purple in our sunsets?
I'll tell you what, there's an Alder Master Station. It's called in England, you know?
Yep.
And the citizens put it up to test for nuclear waste from nuclear plants because of leaks and the high leukemia incidents in England.
Right, so they put this thing up looking for leaks from their own local nuclear power plants.
That's what they were doing.
Sort of an early warning system.
That's what they were, early warning. So what happens? It was rumored that the levels were real high. So a Freedom of Information Act was used because the institute refused to give its findings. This was in 2002 or 3. And they got the Freedom of Information Act through. Chris Busby's report is found on the Internet. He's a scholar there, a PhD. 500% increase in uranium oxide levels in Britain in, like, 2003.
Now,
what was going on in 2002?
All right. Well,
the bombing campaign.
Yeah, in the bombing of Baghdad, the bombing
exactly,
of Iraq.
Exactly. There is so much uranium oxide and uranium gas in the atmosphere that now the sun sets. Because uranium, you remember the old glass in the Depression era? They had colored glass, Vaseline glass.
Yeah, they used to have lead glass. My parents used to collect it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some of that color is from uranium oxide.
Mm-hmm.
So this change in the sunsets is due to the increased levels proven by the British at the Aldermaster station. It's even proven here, but it's covered up. We don't hear it, but the sensors can detect increased uranium levels in the atmosphere here. And also, interesting, in Florida, Hohenstein and his group reported that the cancer rate has increased suspiciously in Florida, lung cancer, by fourfold this year. They've noticed a fourfold increase in cancer.
But cancer typically doesn't develop in a year or two. That is just something that usually takes decades.
Not with uranium, though. Uranium metal can induce a tumor within 12 months. It's pretty wicked.
Because it's emitting alpha particles?
Exactly.
Now,
and you've seen this in service people. On autopsy, they'll see the carcinoma and the scarring in the lung tissue from the inhalation of the uranium metal.
Now, I thought that the main danger of uranium metal was actually just that it's a toxic metal like lead. You know, all the actinides,
sure,
I guess, are toxic, and that the primary toxicity, the locus of that toxicity, is the kidneys.
Well, definitely the servicemen are seeing kidney damage. I mean, here's the Brit who's suing Honeywell out of the Guardian, British soldier sues the U.S. giant. He had terrible kidney damage from uranium. And the depleted uranium also caused him to have lung damage. And he had tests done. He can't move his arms. He's got pain in his limbs. He has broken chromosomes.
Which are typically the result of what? Exposure to the radiation?
Exactly.
In the uranium? Okay.
Exactly.
So
it's a heavy metal. Like you said, it's a heavy metal. Here's the issue. This is what we know about now. It's a heavy metal, so it's twice as heavy as lead, and it attaches to the DNA. So it breaks it apart because it's so dense, but then it emits the gamma irradiation, the alpha particles. It's emitting these things.
Which break up the DNA.
It shatters it.
Pop holes in it, throw adenosine.
We have the report also from the congenital malformations in Iraq and Basra. We have the report, 1990. It's a very 30-page article that I have here. 1990, there were 3 per thousand of, defects in a child.
Right.
Which is still a little high. 3 per thousand. Bombing starts in 91. Every year, up. And 2001, even before the big bombing, it's a 20%, it's a 200% increase.
Wow.
200% increase. Now it's at 1,000%. In other words, let's say that you had 20 malformations and 1,000 in 2001. Now you've got 100. What's the common question on the Iraqi hospitals after a delivery? Doctor, is it normal?
We're talking with Dr. Cass Ingram. He's the author of Natural Cures for Health Disasters. The website is p-73.com. The number p-73.com. And we're talking about uranium oxide, also known as depleted uranium or vaporized depleted uranium.
It's a bit of a PR thing to call it depleted uranium. You know what it really is. It's nuclear waste. You know the stuff in the drums that's sitting out? They just take that, use that to make munitions. It's a waste product of making armaments, and it's a waste product of the nuclear power plants. It has nothing to do with depletion.
Now, the military says, and the U.S. government, for that matter, says, this is not that big a deal, and uranium is a really heavy metal, and so it gets into the dirt, but it settles, deep down into the soil, and you really don't have to worry about this stuff.
Isn't that the same government that said that 19 guys from Yemen and Saudi Arabia brought down the World Trade Centers?
Yeah.
Because the FBI's list has now been proven to be that 10 or even 11 of the 19 are still alive and weren't in the country at the same time.
Well, I think perhaps a better analogy might be this is the same government that told us in the 1950s that living downwind of the nuclear tests in Nevada was no problem.
Right.
And John Wayne died of lung cancer. He
and
was
so
on a movie set.
And so did the guy from Bonanza, that Michael Landon.
Yeah.
And so did...
He had pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. But that's a very good analogy. In fact, another interesting thing is we had a government that was injecting plutonium in certain people and not telling them that.
Back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. And a number of them have died, of course, of very aggressive cancer.
So, Cass Ingram, what do we do about this? How do we get the government to stop converting nuclear waste into weapons?
Well, we have to find out who's making, we'll follow the money. You know, once you do that, the whole thing unwinds.
So where is the money? Who's making these weapons?
Well, there's the Honeywell's making them, and certainly General Dynamics, and certainly there's probably 100 different major companies. Boeing has earned massively on this whole program. General Electric earns billions of dollars on this war. So there's a handful of companies that are earning many multi-billions and multi-hundreds of millions of dollars. But the common man doesn't see it, and the common man is going on disability because he fought the war, and now he has uranium poisoning, or she. So I would say we've got to have more research on who's defrauding us, making us think that we have to have this bombing and we have to have these wars, and yet they're lining their pockets with billions. And then the second thing is, people, you might want to think twice about, you know, putting your young kids on the line there. Because not so much they won't survive, they'll probably make it out, but what about the long-term damage of uranium metal emitting radioactive ions in their bodies? How are we going to recover them from that? It's not easy. Now, I do have in my book, Natural Cures for Health Disasters, a huge section on decontaminating radiation poisoning, and it's effective, and we've used it on Chernobyl victims, so I'm not just a, you know, guy out of the streets here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done it. We've gotten tumors to dissolve, but it's, you know, it's
why. How do you do it?
Yeah.
How do you do it, Cass Ingram?
We do it with spice extracts. They're very rich in antioxidants.
Turmeric?
Yes, but more particularly oil of wild oregano and also the waters of oregano. This is what we used on Chernobyl victims getting their huge cantaloupe-sized cancers to die. We gave them juice of wild oregano. Oil would be good also.
I've heard of oregano being used as a vermifuge. You know,
yeah, it's a good vermifuge.
Kill parasites.
Here's the deal. When you have the uranium poisoning, you develop mutations in your bacteria, and they kill you. So there are two benefits, like you say, the wild oregano killing the parasites, the fungus, but also, for some reason, its antioxidant power is being three times more powerful than vitamin E. Now, the other thing we use is high doses of selenium. And there's another weird product called Nuke Protect, a name that was invented long before our talk. But Nuke Protect protects the thyroid and regenerates the thyroid. So what I usually do is I say, look, follow the book, but get some Nuke Protect, get the juice of oregano, the oil of oregano.
Is that a lot of DULS, a lot of iodine content in seaweeds?
Pushing it for these. If there's, like, for example, right now in our country, people live within 5 miles of a nuclear plant. They call me up. They're sick. Their joints are aching. They can't move. They're developing, precancerous lesions. There's somebody that, you know, they're getting maybe even some swelling in their lymph glands. And I'm telling them, you got to detox you. There's something else out now called Total Body Purge, which is a total body purge, which is spice oils, greens, and olive oil, and you drink that. So there's options for people. You know?
Amazing stuff. I'd say the main option is to stop putting the stuff in our environment.
Stop that. I hope your program gets heard in D.C. Stop it.
It does.
You're going to have to bomb. It does. A regular bomb. You know?
There you go. Dr. Cass Ingram, his website, p-73.com. He's the author of Natural Cures for Health Disasters. Thanks for being with us today, sir. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
And welcome back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Let me just be on record as saying I am totally creeped out by the idea that our sunsets are turning purple because of uranium oxide in the air. And, I've seen the science. I don't dispute that. And on the other hand, if I knew somebody who had uranium poisoning, I don't think that the first thing I'd do is say, go get some oregano. I don't know. Maybe call me old-fashioned. But Victoria Jones, our senior Senate correspondent, is with us in the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, I just got out of a press conference with Senators Reid, Levin, Reid, Salazar, Feinstein, and Biden.
Reids? Two Reids?
The two Reids were there.
Uh-huh.
Reid and Reid.
Holy cow.
Sounds like a law firm, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, Reed and Sons or something.
Yeah,
Reed and Daughters.
They were there because they wanted to talk about the amendment on Iraq that was voted on this morning. They got 40 votes on one of the amendments, and on the one that doesn't have a definite date, and there were 13 votes, I believe, for the one, the Kerry amendment that does have a definite date.
Well, that's a lot more than they were expecting.
Yeah, it is more than they were expecting. Senator Feinstein is saying that a real majority of the Democrats in the Senate support this one, and basically as what our policy should be, because there were questions as to whether they actually had a policy, and basically she seems to be saying that this amendment reflects what the Democrats' policy is.
Right.
Senator Reid from Nevada said the Republicans stand alone, saying there should be no plan in Iraq, and he accused the Republicans of having a rubber-stamp Congress and a rubber-stamp Republican-controlled Senate. So he was a little ticked off. Senator Biden said that the Republicans are totally united in a failed policy. Senator Reid from Rhode Island said essentially what they did was provide cover for the White House.
Yeah.
So
well,
they're not happy.
There's this weird kind of catch 22 thing here to all of this, Victoria Jones, and correct me if I've already had this conversation with you. I think I had it with Louise yesterday, but it seems, you know, if you think back to the last few years of the Clinton administration, the Republicans had basically taken over, you know, in the House certainly, and the Senate, part of the Senate, and so many of the spending cuts that were passed during the last 3-4 years of the Clinton administration were passed not because Bill Clinton wanted them, but because the Republicans wanted them. Those spending cuts then led to balanced budgets and you know, a surplus, which Bill Clinton then took credit for. Now, I'll give him credit. He played a large role in it. But if it had been an entirely Democratic Congress, I'm not sure it would have happened. On the other hand, and so here's the net effect is that the Republicans did something that I think to this day they're shooting themselves in the foot for. That is, they made things good, and Clinton got the credit for it. And today, if Clinton could run for president, he'd probably get elected in a heartbeat, in part because of things that the Republicans did back in the late 90s.
You're right.
Now, if the Democrats are successful in forcing the Republicans to get us out of Iraq by July of 2008... as one of these proposals is suggesting, that means that the Democrats are going to go into the 2008 election with the Republicans claiming victory in Iraq.
That is an example of catch-22.
Yeah.
And we have General Casey, who is having a briefing today with Donald Rumsfeld, in which it is expected, I don't know this to be the case, that he may talk about a little bit of a drawdown of troops.
Right. So my guess is that the two October surprises are going to be that October, and again, you know, we saw Richard Nixon play this like a fiddle with Vietnam. I mean, he got elected against Hubert Humphrey. He got elected by saying he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And my guess is that what we're going to see is a drawdown of troops just in time for the November elections, to the point where people can say the average kind of, you know, Joe Sixpack sitting on the fence, not paying much attention to politics. Well, it looks like Bush is starting to get us out of Iraq. That's a good thing. You know, draw down 20, 30, 40,000 troops, some not insignificant portion. And then in September, October, November of 2008, 2 years from now and change, you're going to see pretty much all of our troops out of there.
I would expect, which would be a good thing. I would expect to see that. I think that is exactly the way that Karl Rove thinks. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there is a small number of troops coming out before the elections in 2006.
Yeah, and the danger, I mean, all of us want the troops out, and we want the troops out now. I want the troops out now. I mean, it's just, it is insane that our young men and women are caught in the middle of a civil war, and that they're running around with bullseyes on their backs, you know, occupying a country. But Bush is not going to take them out now. He's going to let a few more people die. He's going to let a few more hundred people die at the very least. And if you include Iraqis in that, people as people, and they are after all, he's going to let thousands of more people die in order to time this thing right politically. And then he's going to let more people die throughout 2007 so he can go in the tank politically, so he can, you know, come back out again in 2008. If my political calculus is right. And the Democrats are going to facilitate it.
But, you know, that is a risk. That is such a high-stakes risk because you can't control foreign policy. You cannot control what other countries do.
No, but you can control when you decide to get out.
You can, but what happens if Iran invades?
Oh, they're not going to. Iran has not invaded another country in 600 years.
I know, but I'm just giving an example. What happens if somebody else gets ticked off? What happens,
yeah.
You know?
I think the big what if happens is really what if there's a civil war. And in that case, then you do the Biden thing. You balkanize the country.
Yes,
and that may be the best thing.
That
may be the best thing. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Let me say thank you to those who love money. Let me say thank you to those who still play fair. Hallelujah, the meek shall inherit. Let me say thank you to all you people out there.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The biggest story of, in my opinion, the last, well, frankly, at least the last half century, arguably the biggest story since World War II, has been whether or not the elections of 2000 and 2004 were stolen, and I would toss 2002 into that pot as well, were stolen by the Republicans, and if so, how, and if so, and we know how, why it has not been investigated or looked into. Stephen Freeman and Joel Bleifuss have written a new book called Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? Subtitled Exit Polls, Election Fraud, and the Official Count. Stephen Freeman, you're one of the computer scientists or one of the statistical scientists. You describe yourself for us here, I'd say.
Yeah, hi. I teach research methods at the University of Pennsylvania, so... You know, I have some background in all the related fields of politics and statistical analysis and engineering and computer science. So,
yeah, and Joel Bleifuss is an editor of In These Times and an investigative reporter and columnist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Dissent, Utney Reader, and other publications. So, Stephen, and welcome, Joel, to the program.
Glad to be here. Yeah, it's terrific to be here. Thanks,
Stephen. I'm curious, as a mathematician, statistician, as a scientist who knows how to look at numbers, what's wrong with the 2004 election?
It's almost hard to know where to begin on that question, but we can begin with the exit polls. As most people know, the exit polls did in fact project a Kerry victory on election day of 2004. What few people know, because the story was so unreported and misreported, is the magnitude of that discrepancy. It was an enormous discrepancy. Bush won the election by the official count by about 3 million votes, and a very narrow electoral vote victory, but by exit poll indications, Kerry won the election by something on the order to 6 to 7 million votes, a discrepancy of about 9 million votes nationwide. And
out of about 100 million people who voted?
120 million people.
120 million.
And would have won a decisive electoral victory. Ohio, Nevada, New Mexico were all Kerry victories, well beyond polling margin of errors. And several other states, including Florida and Iowa, he was projected ahead, albeit by a much more narrow margin.
So here's the question, Joel Bleifuss. If it looks like 1 out of 10, roughly, or maybe 1 out of 11 votes in the United States was flipped or stolen in some way, how is it possible that that could happen without somebody coming forward and saying, yeah, I was part of the conspiracy?
Well, I think one of the big factors in 2004 was that for the first time in our history, 64% of voters voted on either direct recorded electronic voting machines or an optical scan systems. And this is as a result of HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, which is asking the country to move away from punch card systems. But a report by the General Accounting Office in 2005 said that such systems have lacked security and they contain flaws that could, quote, could allow unauthorized personnel to disrupt operations or modify data and programs that are critical to the accuracy and integrity of the voting process.
Right, it could. But again, the question, if this is the result of a conspiracy, and it would almost have to be, if you see state after state after state where the exit polls show that Kerry was winning and Bush, in fact, won, if you have thousands of reports, and I know there are actually tens of thousands of reports of people who have said that they walked into electronic voting machine booths, they pushed the Kerry button, and the machine said, essentially, thank you for voting for George Bush. The Bush button lit up. These kinds of stories. And the vast majority, I mean, some mind-boggling percentage, and Stephen Freeman probably knows the numbers on this, of these so-called errors fell to the side of Bush, not to the side of Kerry. Right, Stephen?
Yeah, those numbers have never really been compiled systematically. Anecdotally, what you say is true, that the overwhelming number of stories you hear about that, something on the order of 95 to 100%.
Okay, so if that's the case, that would certainly imply a conspiracy, which brings us back to the question, Joel Bleifuss, how could such a conspiracy function without being outed? Or has it been outed and it simply hasn't been reported on?
Well, I think that you have two factors to look at. One here. One is that these electoral systems are centralized. They rely on these voting systems rely on software and programs that we have no sort of control over. They can be accessed by insiders, manipulated, and so it would take a relatively small number of people to pull off something like this by tampering with the voting software. And then I think one also has to look at the larger context of the election, and this goes for 2000 as well as 2004, the huge numbers of reports of sort of organized quasi-legal and illegal vote suppression. Now, this is particularly true in Ohio, which has been very well documented that under the leadership of the Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell, who was also the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign, there was a very concerted effort to decrease vote in the Democratic area.
This is what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. documented so well in his Rolling Stone article a couple of weeks ago, 350,000 votes stolen, the vast majority of them actually by good old-fashioned Jim Crow techniques of switching around polling places and not having enough voting machines or pulling people off the polls and the strategy of the Republicans having people register to vote, and if they checked the Democratic box, they threw away their registration, these kinds of things.
Exactly. Yeah, there's this report by the Democratic National Committee that found that African Americans, new registrants, and younger voters were those who experienced the most problems. And in fact, twice as many African American voters as white voters reported experience voting problems.
Right. VWB, voting while black, the new crime in America. Stephen Freeman, you were going to say you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I was going to add a little something to that, and that I think Robert F. Kennedy did a terrific job documenting all these votes that were suppressed and, in some cases, vote switched. But these were the ones that were more easy to document. The ones on electronic voting, of course, there's no audit trail at all. So those you cannot really prove in any systematic way. The exit polls measured, they do not even account for all the votes that may have been suppressed. It's only the people who've overcome the hurdles of registration and actually believe they've cast a ballot.
Well, except that the exit polls also include people who showed up, were told that they weren't on the list, they cast a provisional ballot, they left thinking that they had voted, and then when those provisional ballots were tabulated, they didn't find their names on the rolls, and so they got thrown away.
Yes, it may have included some of those. We're not entirely sure. One problem with the exit polls is that it was a media poll, and their methods and processes are not very transparent. So we don't know the details of how those provisional votes may have been recorded.
Yeah. Now, here's the big question for both of you. We can go through and dissect the theft of the 2004 election, or for that matter, the 2002 or the 2000 election, all of which I think that there's plenty of evidence for. And we've frankly done that on this program a number of times with a number of people, and you guys have written a brilliant book about it. Was the 2004 presidential election stolen? Exit polls, election fraud, and the official count by Stephen Freeman and Joel Bleifuss. What do we do to prevent this from happening in 2006 and in 2008? What is being done? Is anybody organizing national exit polls, for example?
Well, I think that there's
Joel, go ahead.
One thing is that Representative Rush Holt, a Democrat from New Jersey, has introduced the Voter Confidence and Increased Accessibility Act, House Bill 550, that would require the use of a voter-verified paper record in audits and counts.
But doesn't that bill then allow for optical scan machines that could be just as badly corrupted? You just now have a paper trail, and you can still get around that the way that they did in Ohio? I mean, it seems to me like Rush Holt's bill might actually be the Trojan horse.
Yes, it may well be. And this is the kind of problem that that you cannot simply vote your way out of or legislate your way out of. And the first step, really, in doing something about it is getting America to wake up to it. Yeah. I mean, you and your listeners may be aware of this, but to 95% of the country, what we have to report is shocking, almost unbelievable news.
Yeah, Stephen Freeman.
Shouldn't
we be organizing? We only have a few seconds left.
Okay.
Shouldn't we be doing like they did in the Ukraine? Shouldn't we be organizing right now exit polls and putting together a system to publicize the results of those exit polls before the official results come out in 2006?
Yeah, I'm actually in the process of trying to organize something like that.
Is there a website people can go to help you?
It's a large organization. Yes, I have a website on called electionintegrity.org, and it's a pretty new effort. I put most of my effort into writing the book with Joel, but now we're focused on actually trying to do something about it. And yes, we are trying to put together not only exit polls, but other means for verifying the election.
Electionintegrity.org. A new book, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? Exit Polls, Election Fraud, and the Official Count. Stephen Freeman and Joel Bleifuss. Pick it up. Check it out. Buy a copy. Read it. Pass it along. Share it with 15 friends or more. Stephen and Joel, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Okay, thank you.
Good talking with you both. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away?
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour here. It's sometimes it just gets very, very weird. And the very, very weird right now is over here now. I remember when I tried to cancel AOL. And this was about 5 years ago. And three times I called. Actually, I called five or six times. Three times I actually got through to an operator. Three times after going through a whole long song and dance, they told me my account was canceled, and every time I kept getting bills. And this went on, this was over an 8-month period. I ultimately had to call my credit card company and tell them my credit card had been stolen, so they'd issue me a new number in order to stop AOL having the ability to bill my credit card. And here's this guy, Vincent Ferrari. He calls up AOL. He says, cancel my account.
On June 2nd, I don't know how to make it any clearer.
Last year was 540. Last month was 545 hours of usage.
I don't know how to make this any clearer, so I'm just going to say it one last time. Cancel the account.
Well,
please.
Explain to me why.
I'm not explaining anything to you. Cancel the account.
Well, what's the matter, man? So, I mean, I'm just trying to help here.
You're not helping me. You're helping me with.
Yeah, I am trying to help.
Helping me. Listen, I called to cancel the account. Helping me would be canceling the account. Please help me and cancel.
No, it wouldn't actually.
Cancel
your account.
Cancel the account.
Is your dad there?
I'm the primary payer.
This guy's 31 years old.
Not my dad. Cancel the account.
Okay, because I'm just trying to figure out.
Cancel the account. I don't know how to make this any clearer for you. Cancel the account. The card is mine in my name.
Okay.
The account is mine and in my name. When I say cancel the account, I don't mean help me figure out how to keep it. I mean cancel the account.
I'm sorry. I don't know what anybody's done to you, Vincent, but this is kind
of... You're annoying the shit out of me. That's what you're doing to me. Cancel the account, please.
Okay. And that goes both ways, my friend.
Good. Could you please cancel the account?
All right. Someday, when you calm down, you're going to realize all I was trying to do was help you, and it was actually in your best interest to listen.
Wonderful. Okay, yeah, great.
When that epiphany happens, then you should give us a call back.
Wait.
As a process of cancellation request. Like they said, about a free benefit available for valued members like yourself.
Oh, now a sales pitch.
We'll continue to provide you some features available.
Don't want it. I know the drill. I don't even want it. Don't even bother. Just
if you want me to cancel this account, you're going to let me speak.
On it goes. I mean, this is like, you know, there's like 4 minutes of this. It is amazing. This guy finally is like, okay, enough already. And he actually put the audio up on the web. Good on you. Patsy in Faircrest, Washington. Hey, Patsy, what's on your mind today?
Oh, it was about Iraq. You were talking earlier and about, you know, the Senate and how they got 13 votes to get out of Iraq. Well, I was looking at the Zoghbi poll,
yeah.
You know, the international poll.
Yes.
And they did a poll of servicemen in Iraq, and 72% of the servicemen said it's time to get out, end operations by the end of 06.
That's
now,
right.
My question is, why aren't the senators hearing this? They're not hearing from the men in Iraq. Why?
Well, the senators have heard this. The problem is that the Republican Party has decided that getting out of Iraq will probably be politically a very good idea. A few months, at the very most, before an election. But other than that, they're not going to do it because their buddies are making so much money. There is so much money to be made in Iraq right now.
Yeah. It's really disgusting, to be perfectly honest with you.
It really, it truly is. I agree.
And those, you know, six senators, Feingold, Harkins, Boxer, Byrd, and Kennedy, they really put that on the line. And I'm glad that other people went along with them.
Yeah.
And I'm disgusted with the Democrats. They should have been at least the party line vote.
Well, I agree it should have been a party line vote. You've got a lot of them who are frankly terrified of this stuff. There's elections coming up. There are swing districts, and the Republicans are using, they're playing this thing like a fiddle. And frankly, there's some Democrats who realize that the Joseph Goebbels strategy of telling the big lie actually does work sometimes, and I think that they're afraid of it. I'm not giving them any, you know, I'm not trying to cut them any slack. I'm just saying, you know, they're doing the political calculus, and they're trying to survive. And it's very difficult to survive when you have a choice of either, you know, maintaining your ethics or becoming like your opponent. It's the old Wetiko problem, which we'll talk about some other time on the program when I have a little bit more time. But Patsy, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carlana.
Hi. I want to promote the idea of drafting John Mercer for president. He's the only one the Republicans are really afraid of. And if he were running for president, the reporters would have to chase him around. And he could tell a lot about how the military people are being abused and, you know, mistreated and neglected in addition to the war. And I just think John Murtha is the one voice that's...
Well, I think at least as House Minority Whip, he's going to take on Steny Hoyer as the number two Democrat in the House of Representatives, and I wish him luck on that. Although there's a lot of issues...
He could still do that, but in the meantime, I think it would be useful if he would run as a presidential candidate because he would, in addition to scaring the Republicans and reporters having to chase him around, I think he would help clarify a Democratic position that eventually all of them could rally around.
With regard to the war. But you've got Jack Murtha's in favor of making abortion criminalized, for example.
Well, I just know that he's been the clearest voice so far that the Republicans are really afraid of. And if he were out there every day as a candidate, it would force the whole discussion to tilt in that direction. So
yeah,
I think it would be a big plus if he would.
You know, I agree with you on
the
war.
Make the sacrifice. It would be a personal sacrifice on his part, but it would be. I think it would help clarify all these issues if he would run as a candidate. And you know, just the fact of running, he gets attention that he won't get otherwise.
Well, there's that point is a well made one, Carlana, and a lot of these guys are actually saying that they're running for president just to raise their own profile, even in their own districts. I mean, it's one of the reasons Rick Santorum, I think, is, you know, persistently floating this, so he'll get more face time on national TV, which translates into TV in his own state of Pennsylvania. Although, hopefully, he has put his foot in it in this one, you know, with, oh, we found weapons of mass destruction. They just happen to be 20 years old, but here they are. Oh, man. But Jack Murtha, I mean, you got to understand, Jack Murtha is a very, very conservative guy. And that's why it's such a big deal that he's come out against the war. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So this white flag of surrender that the Democrats are waving about Iraq, please, Mr. Bartlett, Matt Lauer says, Dan Bartlett, the communications director at the White House, please name one Democrat who wants to wave a white flag.
Yeah, a lot of Democrats are calling this president a liar, you know, saying we've gone into Iraq for the wrong reasons. They say he's incompetent.
And probably there's a lot of heated rhetoric in Washington. Maybe that's because you've got a lying incompetent running the White House.
I don't know. So anyhow, Matt Lauer and Dan Bartlett going at it.
I'm sure you'll see it on NBC News. It's got to be one of those things that's going to turn into a soundbite. Bev Harris is with us. She is the big cheese over the founder over at blackboxvoting.org, the author of the book blackboxvoting.org, the same name, and an old and dear friend, Bev Harris. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom.
Bev, first of all, just a heads up, I'm at your website and I'm trying to click on buy this book, and it's not hot linked.
Oh, you know what? We're only giving that away now. Isn't that terrible? And we're going to be coming out with a new edition. So that one, you have to scroll down to the right, and it's all free.
Yeah, I noticed all the chapters were there, yeah. And I thought, gee, everybody's going to be reading the chapters for free, and Bev's not going to get any royalties from the book. Well, that's great that you're getting.
No, I never have gotten any royalties. So, yeah. But the most important thing is to get the word out.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the word, let's just do our update here. We just actually were talking with Stephen Freeman and his co-author on the book of Was the 2004 Election Stolen. And that's, you know, a great look back at 2004. I'd like to look at what's going on right now. What is the situation right now, coast to coast? And what are you seeing coming down the road for 2006 and 2008?
Well, you know, we haven't fixed anything. In fact, we've just gone out and bought more of the machines. The primary season, we're, you know, in full swing right now, and voting machines are proving to be unreliable, proving to get bizarre results. What else is new? The only difference is that a lot more citizens are aware of it, and so now more defects, more problems are being spotted.
Just a quick question, Bev.
Yes.
Pardon my interrupting your stream of thought there, but the glitches, in quotes, or the problems that were reported by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, in the 2000, the 2002, and the 2004 election, almost always, I'm talking like more than 95% of the time, were glitches that favored Republicans over Democrats, which obviously is a statistical impossibility. Is that what you're seeing in this primary election now, or are these problems starting to be a little more random?
I think that's premature to say that, because we understand that we had 40,000 people out in the field watching for this, but they were all people who were pretty much mobilized by the Democrats and by progressive organizations. So the database may have been that, but the data collection was done by a somewhat partisan group. So this time around, what we've got to do is something very different than what we did in 2004. In 2004, we got a lot of stories, and they were important. But what we need to do this time is get evidence. Evidence means photographs, videotapes, audio recordings, and public records, period. We need stuff that will stand up in a court of law, because it's all very nice to come out and say, well, you know, the vote flipped. I voted for this guy and the other guy got the vote, or it showed up on the screen with the other guy. This time, bring a digital camera and take a picture of that screen, or bring an audio recorder. You can get them for $35. They're digital now. And record the transaction, the discussion with the poll worker where you say, hey, it's going to the wrong guy. Can you help me fix this? So you have evidence. Because stories, we're finding out, really don't make change happen.
People, that's amazing,
deny
because
that it happened.
Because there are people sitting on death row all across the United States right now because one person said, well, so-and-so told me, or I saw,
I mean, you know, the testimony of a single person is enough to put a person to death, but the testimony of tens of thousands of Americans is not enough to get the attention of the New York Times?
Correct, because it's political, and I say that in quotes. I'm so tired of hearing that. Well, it's political. So, you know what? What is not political is a videotape, an audio tape, a photograph. If you go and...
Well, won't they say it's been photoshopped?
Pardon?
Won't they say it's been photoshopped?
No, no. I mean, we're finding now that the TV stations, even network TV, they are picking up on the videos that we've shot. Remember, we shot a video in Cuyahoga County during the recount when they were doing an illegal recount after the 2004 election. Three people have been indicted because of that. That's what I mean by it creates real change, and that's still going up the ladder, by the way, there. We shot a video in Leon County, Florida, when we demonstrated hacking the machine. We have been requested by one of the networks today to provide that video so they can air it on national TV.
That's marvelous.
This is what I mean by evidence. You have to, if you see lines of people around the block, if you see police tape, get a photograph of it. It's important because I can tell you, I know someone who was in election protection who went to Cleveland where they had lines around the block, and the person came back and said, well, there weren't any lines. They were very politically correct. And there were. And so it's important that we get something that nobody can argue with, and it's cheap. $35 will get you a little pocket digital audio recorder. You can get some cell phones will take pictures. And the great thing is a lot of these new devices, and we have a guide to them on blackboxvoting.org, they come with a disc so you can load it right into your computer, upload it immediately. But this is the kind of thing we're going to need come 2006. Isn't that sad?
Well, it is, but I think it's great that you're mobilizing a movement to do that. I'm sitting here shocked that it hadn't occurred to me before to do this. You know, and I've been talking about this for, as you know, the better part of 3 years, rather loudly and calling for, you know, national exit polls and, you know, let's do something and let's organize something. And it just hadn't occurred to me that something as simple as get a media record, particularly a video record, I would think that would be the very strongest thing. Because the network television, really, if there's no video, it doesn't happen on network TV.
That's right. And there's one more thing. We have on blackboxvoting.org now organized the National Hand Count Registry. What that is we encourage people to go there and volunteer to hand count if needed. Because the most amazing things are happening because election officials are claiming that citizens aren't available to hand count if needed. In Cleveland, in the May 2nd primary, they had 17,000 votes that the voting machines could not read. They had paper ballots on these votes. The voting machines just didn't work. So what did they do? Instead of calling in hand count citizens because they said there were none, they punched them into touch screens. They hired someone to come in and push each one of the 17,000 ballots into a touch screen. In Riverside, California, it was worse. In California, there's a law that says if you don't trust that touch screen, you can get a paper ballot. The citizens who got paper ballots discovered that later on, those paper ballots were not hand counted. They were pushed into a touch screen. So we want there to be no excuses. One of the things we have at blackboxvoting.org now is you just push a button, sign up for it. Hundreds and hundreds of people are signing up for it every hour. And we want to be able to say, no, there's people who will hand count, and there's even people who will travel to hand count.
Yeah.
So you can no longer tell us that you have to do these crazy gymnastics gyrations. You know, let's count the vote.
Yeah. Let me toss in one other suggestion for you, Bev Harris. Maybe this is just, you know, weird and off the wall, but, you know, I know at least two people who in the last year have bought a new video camera and already owned a video camera 4, 5, 6 years old. You know, and they're just sitting around. They have essentially no value.
Yes.
Somebody ought to create basically a clearinghouse. If you have a video camera.
We've done that. You thought of that. Well, you know, we have it on our donations page right now, and we just put it up yesterday. We said what we're going to do here is people, if they have extra video cameras, digital cameras, audio recorders, what have you, they can send them in, and then starting about August, we will start. Of course, we know which citizens are consistently out in the field, and sometimes there are people who happen to be unemployed and don't have a lot of money, and we can provide them with the tools they need to document, and these will be people that we know will document because they have that history already, so it's not just handing something off to somebody you don't even know. I think that's so important because I know I just got a digital camera. The new digital cameras, by the way, for about $300, you can get one that'll take photos and web quality video, and you can just take this little card out and put it right in your computer and upload the stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. For $300 now, it's what you got for thousands of years ago.
Right. So, of course, you don't use the old one because the new one's so cool. And yet there are people who would use that, and we need to get out there and document. I think it is a sad thing that we are at this point where it seems that nobody's listening who is in a position to really do something. But on the other hand, you know what? As I put recently, you know, perhaps this is Einstein's theory of democracy. We the people equals us.
There you go. Well said. Bev Harris with blackboxvoting.org, the founder of Black Box Voting, the author of the book Black Box Voting. Check it out, blackboxvoting.org right now. This is brilliant. Bev, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great speaking with you, as always. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. We'd take that. We really would. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
It's our Taking My Country Back segment.
Johnson's been all overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. The budget and you lost Iraq, so I'm taking my country back.
A few months ago, we asked Congressman Bernie Sanders, you know, how should we, what should we do? Give money to the Democratic Party, the DCCC, what do we do? And he said, go out and find individual candidates. Find individual candidates who are running for office, who are good progressives and who you want to support. Put out their websites, encourage people to go to their websites, give them money, give them support, get them mobilized. And so that's what we're doing. Every week we're featuring a Democrat that we have pre-vetted, as it were, and in our Taking Your Country Back segment.
I am taking my country back.
And today it's Darcy Berner. Darcy Berner is running as a Democrat for the 8th Congressional District in the state of Washington in 2006. She's running against Republican incumbent Paul Reichert, who Karl Rove personally is going to be coming out and doing fundraising for. Darcy, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you, Darcy. Darcy, DarcyBurner.com, the website, DarcyBurner.com, the website. Darcy, tell us why should people in your district, in the 8th Congressional District in the state of Washington, get involved and get behind your candidacy?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First, they really deserve a member of Congress who is going to come to Washington, D.C. and fight for them instead of fighting for the Republican Party and its leadership. And second, because this is one of the 15 seats that Democrats need to take the House of Representatives. If we want to take our country back, we've got to take back the Congress one seat at a time.
Oh, man. Now, you, on your website, you talk about taking this country in a new direction. Let's just go through some of these issues that you have listed here. By the way, I want to add Patty Murray, Senator Patty Murray, of the Democrat from the state of Washington, has endorsed your candidacy.
And, that's true.
Good on you, Patty Murray, for that. Number one, helping families who work hard and play by the rules to get ahead through investments in education, health care, and training our workers for new jobs with good wages. What specifically, you know, how specifically do you do this?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, you don't slash funding for student loans, as my opponent in the Republican Congress does. For Head Start programs, you don't dramatically underfund a mandate that the federal government puts on the public schools at the normal level. We need to be decreasing the interest rates on student loans while increasing the funding so that every kid who works hard has an opportunity for a college education. We need to be making sure that we get kids earlier and earlier. All of the research shows that for every dollar we invest in early childhood education, we get about $14 in return on investment. Those investments make sense not only from a social perspective, but also from a fiscal one. And we need to be making sure that our schools are performing as well as we possibly can, and that includes giving them the resources that they need. And frankly, we've got to create good new jobs in the United States, which is, given my background in business, a huge part of what I'd like to do.
What is your background in business, Darcy Berner?
I worked for about a dozen years in high technology, including 5 years at Microsoft. And I thought that I was going to change the world and make it a better place by building software solutions that would solve problems that we couldn't solve. I had a son about 3 years ago, and after he was born, I realized that I couldn't give him the kind of life I wanted him to have unless we dramatically changed the direction of the country. So I left that career to do this.
Good on you. Darcy, we're talking with Darcy Berner. Her website, D-A-R-C-Y, Darcy Berner, B-U-R-N-E-R.com. Go check it out right now, DarcyBerner.com. You say holding our government accountable is one of your high priorities. What does that mean?
Well, the Congress has an obligation to be asking really tough questions on behalf of the people. What is our plan for finishing the job in Iraq and bringing our troops home? What happens if full-scale civil war breaks out? How do we deal with the fact that we have millions of Americans who have no access to health care because they don't have health insurance? What are we going to do about creating new good jobs in this country? And right now, there is no level of accountability in the Congress. My opponent, when asked about Iraq, responded, and I quote, by saying, "I put my trust in the president."
This is Paul Reichert.
Dave Reichert, yes.
Or Dave Reichert, I'm sorry.
Dave.
And he says, I just put my trust in the president. That's it.
That's his answer. And that's the answer of far too many of the Republican members of Congress. Their first obligation should be to the people in their districts, not to some other elected official.
That's, yes, absolutely. Well said. Achieving real energy independence, Darcy Berner.
Yes. So we have a huge problem right now, obviously, with oil. I think all of us are well aware of it. The problem is economic. We send huge amounts of money overseas, and people are having to choose between buying gas and buying food. It is a problem environmentally, and it is a problem in terms of national security. But we should solve this problem the same way that we have solved every other major challenge that America has faced. We should innovate our way out of it. We can build, if we decide to, clean, renewable, new technologies that will provide cheap energy everywhere we need it. We just need to make the investments.
Brilliant, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Darcy Berner, she is running as a Democrat against Dave Reichert in the 8th Congressional District of the state of Washington. Her website, DarcyBerner.com, DarcyBurner.com. Check it out. Participate. Here's somebody you can get behind. Darcy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me here.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's good to be king, just for a while, to be there in velvet. Yeah, to give them a smile. It's good to get high and never come down. It's good to be king of your own little town.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Sometimes it's useful to revisit your statement of purpose, your charter. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America in Congress, July 4th, 1776, when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights,
that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. The history of the present King of Britain, the third George to rule. I just added that part. Since we now are on our third George, I mean, what the heck? The history of the present King of Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And here now the bill of attained the list of grievances against George the Third. Let's see, George Washington, George the First, George Herbert Walker, George the Second, George, well, okay, here's the list. In part, I'm not reading all of them, but most of them. He has refused to assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. Gee, do I remember Denny Hastert holding votes on things like the Patriot Act at 3 o'clock in the morning? He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our New Orleans towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. Yeah, I tossed New Orleans in there. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries employed by Halliburton. No, I just put that in there. To complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Thanks to Randy White for the reminder. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Harriet in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Harriet, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Follow that.
I'm sorry?
I said follow that.
Follow that.
Well, hard to follow the Declaration of Independence.
Well, I can't do that. You know, you're the intellectual, and I really appreciate you, Tommy. You're great. I don't listen to most of the other people on your station, but I listen to you because you're so cerebral. But listen to this. I think the problem here is that when you do a Take Back America section, I want to hear ideas. What can we do? You know, it's all fine theoretical to talk about 20 years from now we'll have this and this will happen, and you know, but what can we do now? And I'm tired of people ranting and raving about the problems. Yeah, we got the problems. What are we going to do about them?
Well, here's what you can do. You can go to DarcyBurns.com right now and give her $25. And forego having, you know, lunch at a restaurant tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The other thing I've been taking bulletins, putting them on all the SUVs that I see, and say, you know, you're ruining the heavens and the earth.
Mm.
Yeah. And you're taking up 3 car parking places.
Well,
you know, this is the kind
good
of stuff that people have to do.
Yeah, I mean, see, this is the thing. Every one of us has a different form of activism, and there is no one right form of activism.
No,
if you look
no,
out
no,
at the
no.
thousands of things that people can do, every single person is going to have a different inclination. For some, it's going to be running for political office. For others, it's going to be calling talk radio. For others, it's going to be putting posters on cars. For others, it's going to be sending $25 to Darcy Burns.
Well, but the thing is, it has to be something now. It can't be something 20 years from now, something that's going to happen, you know, theoretically. I think that people have to, and you know, this city, Seattle, Washington, we're surrounded by a bunch of spoiled brat yuppies who represent the upper class, of course, never had an original idea. They just buy cars and tear down 12 houses and make some kind of a commercial establishment they call a house. But, you know,
Harriet, at the end of the day, I would submit to you that those spoiled brat yuppies that you're vilifying are as concerned as you are probably about most of the issues that you are. They just don't realize it. And I think that by calling each other names, we're not serving any forward-looking purpose. I think we really need to be bringing people into this tent, not kicking them out.
Well, I'm just saying, those people have the wherewithal financially to do something right now about.
So we need to be waking them up, not kicking them, in the teeth.
Trying not to wake them up. I'm just trying to make them aware, because people that are upper class do, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, they all had a feeling of responsibility and philanthropic activities that
Good point, Darcy, or Harriet, excuse me. Good point. We used to have in the United States, at least the very rich in the United States, most of them used to have this sense of noblesse oblige. In fact, I would say that George Herbert Walker Bush had that, the sense of the obligations to help out that come along with nobility. And that has, first of all, you know, should we even be in a situation where people are concerned about noblesse oblige? But, you know, nonetheless, that used to be the case. It ain't no more. It certainly isn't the case with George W. Bush. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, earlier in your show you were talking about Santorum's statements about WMDs.
Yeah.
And I just want to make a comment about it. Considering that he's in a real dogfight in his campaign here in Pennsylvania against Casey, I think we're going to be hearing a lot of outrageous things coming out of his mouth in the next 4.5 months.
Yeah, and may every one of them shoot him in the foot.
Right.
It's going to be really interesting to see how this thing plays in the state of Pennsylvania, because Fox News is doing all they can to take this, it's one of those weaselly things, because it's not quite a lie. The fact of the matter is that we have found a couple of hundred, it appears to be around 500, old munitions shells that have leftover sarin gas in them or mustard gas in them. They are degraded. They're all pre-1991. They're things that, this is not stuff that Saddam was hoarding. This is stuff that, you know, somehow fell through, you know, slipped through the cracks in the system where he was trying to destroy his own weapons of mass destruction, or that the weapons inspectors missed. So, in a way, Santorum is saying something that's true, but, you know, that's, come on, that is not why we went to war with Iraq, at least not according to George W. Bush. According to George W. Bush, there was a serious and pressing threat.
Well, I agree with you, and he was making some inroads into his percentages against Casey, because Casey was way ahead in the beginning, but now he's slipping back down again. The most recent poll, he's 18 points down again.
That's great, may he go much, much farther, Jim. May he go much, much farther. I'm telling you, the only area I think where Casey is vulnerable probably is immigration, and that's where Santorum is going to come after him in the last month. Mark my words, 45 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't throw your head in the sand.
And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. 942 days, 10 hours, 9 minutes, 32 seconds. Have faith, my friends. 942 days until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. That is assuming that there is no impeachment process. And I'm not sure that that's a safe assumption. I think it's absolutely fascinating that the Republicans were running around like chickens there for a couple of weeks. It was, you know, I was getting at least four or five emails a day from the various Republican and Republican-affiliated groups that send out emails to talk show hosts. And all the right-wing talk show hosts, of course, were picking up these talking points about how, if the Democrats are elected, they're going to impeach Bush. Oh, no! Thinking that it was going to get their base all stirred up. And then all of a sudden, boom, they stopped. There was just this sudden right bang, right up against the wall. And I haven't heard a single peep out of them about impeachment. And I just have to assume it's because somebody said, hey, you know, we've been talking a lot about impeachment. Maybe somebody ought to do a poll of Republicans and see what they think. And a lot of Republicans came back and said, yes, throw the bum out. And at that point, the Republican National Committee said, hey, yeah, we better not talk about this anymore. In fact, the more we talk about how Democrats get elected, they're going to impeach Bush, the more people are going to vote for the Democrats. Oh, no! Anyhow, let's check out what's happening with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die, and there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wire.
In Anbar province, this from Reuters. Developments in the last 24 hours. Four U.S. soldiers were killed on Tuesday in two separate attacks in Iraq's western Anbar province, according to the U.S. military. In Duluya, a gunman killed an Iraqi soldier at his home. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb south of town. In Hawija, a gunman killed a carpenter on Wednesday. And in Kirkuk, Iraqi soldiers killed a gunman and arrested two on Wednesday after coming under attack in that northern oil city. 1-866-440-8464. Boy, you can tell it's been a long week. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jerry in Edwardsville, Illinois. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I know you've talked about John Locke and the idea of introducing the ownership of property.
Yes.
Thus breaking from the monarch. And according to Locke, how would that property be distributed? He thought, as all those classical liberals do, it would be on the basis of character, initiative versus laziness and all that stuff. And they always took that to be determined really at birth. And if you think about the theory of evolution, contemporary science really undercuts that. Like I think you pointed out in one of your books, how the brain pruning goes on and that's affected by the environment. All
sure.
Kind of evidence that it's not simply the character is just formed at birth. And so it's passed off as though the creationists were the ones opposed to evolution. I wonder if there's not more to that. In other words, I wonder if they're not the front for these liberals, these classical liberals, laissez-faire liberals.
Which is actually what we call conservatives now. It's what the Europeans call liberals.
Yeah. The progressive liberals being, of course, the takeoff of that. And I think the reason the break between the classical laissez-faire liberals and the progressives is this very issue.
Well, actually what you're identifying, Jerry, is the break between Thomas Jefferson and John Locke. You know, Jefferson grew up studying Locke. Locke was dead by the time Jefferson, you know, wrote the Declaration of Independence. But Locke talked about life, liberty, and the ownership of private property. And Jefferson took that phrase and changed it.
said, you know, private property is fine, it's all well and good, but we're really going to be about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We're going to put community first rather than individual personal ownership of property first. And that's where the libertarians and the objectivists miss the boat about what the real spirit and notion and of America is.
Which you always get that thing about, well, how come people are poor? Because they don't have initiative. You know, it's a character flaw.
Yeah, well, if that was true and if it was hereditary, then you would have, you know, you had a lot of poor Irish coming here, you'd still have a lot of poor Irish. You had a lot of poor Italians coming here, you'd still have a lot of poor Italians. The reality is the only place where you can extend that using pure statistics is what the people did with the bell curve, where they said, well, you had a lot of poor Africans come here and you still have a lot of poor African Americans. And the problem with that is that ignores the reality of racism. I mean, you can't look at an Italian, at somebody of Italian ancestry and somebody of Irish ancestry and decide how to discriminate because you don't know what their ancestry was, but you can look at somebody of African American ancestry and discriminate. And so discrimination is still very real. It's still going on in the United States. But you're absolutely right. And it doesn't in any way boil down to any of those issues. Jefferson was very much an egalitarian guy. Leonard in Seattle, hey, very quickly, you said Reichert has some vulnerabilities?
Oh, yes. I volunteered for the Darcy Burner campaign a few days after I saw her on TV. And I got some Reichert literature in the mail, which says he didn't went into support of the repeal of the death tax. And I can't countenance how he can take something that's, you know, a $2.5 million exemption.
Yeah.
Now, and that's going to a $7 million exemption for a couple.
Yeah,
in
so
a few years.
He wants to roll back the Paris tax cut. He's all in favor of the war in Iraq. Not a good guy. Good on Darcy for running against him. And thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry, we're just flat out of time here. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Bernie Sanders will be with us. Also, David Tebow. He's going to say, abstinence only till marriage. That's the only thing we should be teaching in our schools. Yeah, right. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.